From New York, this is Democracy Now!
It is the assessment of the United States government that the Islamic Republic of Iran is responsible for the attacks that occurred in the Gulf of Oman today.
Tensions between the U.S. and Iran are ratcheting up again as the U.S. accuses Iran of orchestrating an attack Thursday on two oil tankers in the Gulf of Oman. But Iran denies any involvement and accuses the Trump administration of trying to sabotage diplomacy. We'll get the latest. Then, as an extradition hearing is held for Julian Assange in London, we look at why one of his friends, the internet activist Olabini, has been jailed in Ecuador for over 2 months. They were arrested on the same day. We'll look at Advocate as well, a new prize-winning documentary about the pioneering Israeli attorney Leah Tzemel, who has spent 5 decades defending Palestinians who resist the Israeli occupation.
I see myself, first of all, as an Israeli, and as such, as a conqueror, as a person who I'm part of holding the Palestinians under occupation for over 50 years. And it's my moral obligation to fight against it.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo Thursday directly blamed Iran for an apparent attack on a pair of oil tankers in the Gulf of Oman near the Strait of Hormuz. Pompeo made the accusation just hours after the incident, which damaged Japanese and Norwegian-owned ships without injuring either ship's crew members.
This assessment is based on intelligence, the weapons used, the level of expertise needed to execute the operation, recent similar Iranian attacks on shipping, and the fact that no proxy group operating in the area has the resources and proficiency to act with such a high degree of sophistication.
A grainy video handout provided by the Pentagon shows what the U.S. claims is surveillance footage of Iran's Revolutionary Guard removing an unexploded mine from the side of the Japanese oil tanker attacked. However, the president of the Japanese company that owns the ship said it was not attacked by mines, but two flying objects. He also said he does not believe any objects were attached to the side of the ship. Iran denied any involvement and accused the Trump administration of trying to sabotage diplomacy. We'll have more on the growing tensions between the U.S. and Iran after headlines with Vijay Prashad. The head of the Federal Elections Commission warned Thursday that candidates for public office are prohibited by law from receiving help from a foreign government. The warning was a clear rebuke to President Trump after he told ABC's George Stephanopoulos this week that he might accept dirt on political rivals from foreign actors in the 2020 election.
Your campaign this time around, if foreigners, if Russia, if China, if someone else offers you information on an opponent, should they accept it or should they call the FBI?
I think maybe you do both. I think you might want to listen. There's nothing wrong with listening. If somebody called from a country, Norway, we have information on your opponent. Oh, I think I'd want to hear it.
You want that kind of interference in our elections?
It's not an interference. They have information. I think I'd take it.
In a statement posted online one day after Trump's remarks aired on ABC, FEC Chair Ellen Weintraub said, "Let me make something 100% clear to the American public and anyone running for public office. It is illegal for any person to solicit, accept, or receive anything of value from a foreign national in connection with the U.S. election. This is not a novel concept," she wrote. White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders said Thursday she'll step down at the end of June after nearly 2 years on the job. As President Trump's spokesperson, Sanders defended the administration's most notorious policies, including the Muslim travel ban, family separations, and the mistreatment of migrants in U.S. custody. Sanders repeatedly lied or repeated the lies of President Trump about basic facts, falsely claiming President Trump never promoted violence at his rallies, denying knowledge about hush money payments Trump paid to former adult film star Stormy Daniels, and making false claims about African-American employment under Trump. Sanders has not held a news conference in 95 days. A photo tweeted by CNN's Megan Vasquez a month ago showed dust gathering on the lectern in the White House briefing room. A federal watchdog recommended Thursday Kellyanne Conway be removed from her post as White House counselor for violating the Hatch Act, a law barring federal employees from engaging in political activity as part of their official duties. In a report submitted to President Trump, the Office of Special Counsel called Conway a repeat offender, saying she's repeatedly used TV appearances and social media to disparage Democratic presidential candidates. Among Conway's ethics violations, she twice violated the Hatch Act by endorsing Alabama Republican Senate candidate Roy Moore while speaking in her official capacity for the White House. In early 2017, Conway used an appearance on Fox and Friends to promote the Ivanka Trump clothing line sold by the president's daughter.
30
go
seconds.
Buy Ivanka's stuff is what I would tell. I'm going to go get some on myself today. It's a wonderful line. I own some of it. I'm going to give a free commercial here. Go buy it today, everybody. You can find it online.
Legal experts say the Office of Special Counsel does not have the authority to discipline Conway, and President Trump can simply ignore the agency's recommendation. In Texas, authorities have recovered the bodies of 7 migrants from waterways near the U.S.-Mexico border within the last week. All 7 appear to have drowned by trying to cross the Rio Grande, which is swollen from spring snowmelt and heavy rains. Elsewhere in Texas, attorneys visiting a migrant processing center in McAllen discovered the U.S. Border Patrol holding a 17-year-old Guatemalan mother and her prematurely born 1-month-old girl, who is described as tiny, lethargic, cold to the touch, and not eating. The mother was in a wheelchair and still recovering from a cesarean section and had barely slept. Immigrant rights attorney Hope Fry said the baby belonged in a hospital neonatal unit, adding, "You look at this baby, and there is no question that this baby should be in a tube with a heart monitor." Both the infant and her 17-year-old mother are considered unaccompanied minors. Under federal law, they should have been released to the Office of Refugee Resettlement within 72 hours, but had been held by the Border Patrol since June 4th until they were reportedly released on Thursday. Meanwhile, Indian officials are blaming an intense heat wave and drought for at least 36 deaths in some region south of Mumbai, India. Whole villages have been evacuated, with an estimated 90% of residents fleeing their homes in recent weeks due to searing drought and crop failures. On Monday, India's capital, Delhi, recorded an all-time high temperature of 48 degrees Celsius, nearly 120 degrees Fahrenheit. This comes as a new study by Brown University finds the U.S. military emits more greenhouse gases each year than many countries, including Sweden and Portugal. The study found that if the Pentagon were a country, its emissions would make it the world's 55th largest contributor. The study's author, Professor Netta Crawford, said, quote, "Climate change is not a potential risk. It has begun with real consequences to the United States. Failing to reduce greenhouse gas emissions will make the nightmare scenario strategists warn against, perhaps even climate war. Wars more likely," she said. In New Zealand, the man accused of massacring Muslim worshippers in the city of Christchurch in March pleaded not guilty Thursday to 51 counts of murder, 40 counts of attempted murder, and engaging in a terrorist act. The 28-year-old Australian's an avowed white supremacist who emailed out a racist manifesto minutes before he opened fire with an assault rifle at 2 mosques, live streaming his massacre on Facebook. His trial's been set for May of 2020. In Gaza, Palestinian medic Mohammed Sobi al-Judaili succumbed to his wounds and died in a hospital Monday after he was shot in the head by Israeli snipers while serving with the Red Crescent at a protest near Israel's separation barrier. He was the 4th medic killed by Israeli forces since weekly nonviolent protests began last year under the banner Great March of Return. In February, a panel of UN investigators found Israeli forces may have committed war crimes and crimes against humanity by targeting the protesters with lethal force, including children, journalists, and the disabled. This comes as Israel says it'll indefinitely bar Palestinian fishing boats from the Mediterranean. Since 2006, Israel has increasingly restricted Gaza fishing vessels from sailing far beyond shore, severely limiting their catch in a territory where more than 10% of children are chronically malnourished. Later in the broadcast, we'll speak with the pioneering attorney Leah Tzemel, who's defended Palestinian political prisoners in Israeli courts for nearly half a century, along with the director of a new film about her titled Advocate. in London. WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange appeared before a magistrate's court today, saying his life was effectively at stake if the UK honors a U.S. request for his extradition. Assange appeared by video link from the high-security Belmarsh prison, where he's serving a 50-week sentence for skipping bail in 2012 when he took refuge in the Ecuadorian embassy in London. U.S. prosecutors have indicted Assange on 18 counts, including 17 counts of violations of the Espionage Act in the first-ever case of a journalist or publisher being indicted under the World War I-era law. Later in the broadcast, we'll look at why one of Assange's friends, the internet activist Olabini, has been jailed in Ecuador for over 2 months. The U.S. is requesting his extradition. They were arrested on the same day. In Michigan, state prosecutors dropped all criminal charges Thursday against eight government officials blamed for poisoning the water supply of Flint with toxic lead, pledging to start over and expand their investigation into the Flint water crisis. The move drew alarm from Flint residents, but also hope that more people might ultimately be held accountable. The crisis began in 2014 when Flint's unelected emergency manager, appointed by Michigan Governor Rick Snyder, switched the source of the city's drinking water in order to save money. The move has been linked to at least 12 deaths from an outbreak of Legionnaire's disease, as well as widespread lead poisoning in residents, including children. Earlier this month, the AP reported authorities used search warrants to seize the state-owned mobile devices of former Governor Snyder and 66 other current or former officials, raising the prospect of a far wider criminal probe under Michigan's newly elected Attorney General Dana Nessel. Prosecutors said they won't answer questions about the revamped probe until after a public meeting in Flint planned for June 28th. Back in the United States, New York State lawmakers on Thursday approved a bill to end religious exemptions for immunizations, and Governor Andrew Cuomo immediately signed it into law. The sometimes deadly disease has spread in recent weeks in Brooklyn and in Rockland County, where vaccination rates in the Orthodox Jewish communities run low. The Centers for Disease Control reports 2019 has seen the greatest number of measles cases reported in the U.S. since 1992. And Massachusetts Senator and 2020 presidential hopeful Elizabeth Warren's introducing a bill to cancel up to $50,000 in student loan debt for 42 million Americans. Senator Warren said in a statement, "The student debt crisis is real and it's crushing millions of people, especially people of color. It's time to decide, are we going to be a country that only helps the rich and powerful get richer and more powerful, or are we going to be a country that invests in its future?" she asked. Meanwhile, the Democratic National Committee Thursday named 20 candidates who've qualified to appear in the first presidential primary debates on the 2020 campaign. The debates will be spread over two nights, with 10 candidates appearing at each event, to be held June 26th and June 27th. Those who did not make the DNC's cut include Montana Governor Steve Bullock, former Alaska Senator Mike Gravel, Miramar, Florida Mayor Wayne Messam, and Congressmember Seth Moulton of Massachusetts. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Tensions between the U.S. and Iran are again ratcheting up as the U.S. accused Iran of orchestrating an attack Thursday on Japanese and Norwegian oil tankers in the Gulf of Oman. Iran denied any involvement and accused the Trump administration of trying to sabotage diplomacy. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo directly accused Iran of attacking the oil tankers just hours after the incident.
"It is the assessment of the United States government that the Islamic Republic of Iran is responsible for the attacks that occurred in the Gulf of Oman today. This assessment is based on intelligence, the weapons used, the level of expertise needed to execute the operation, recent similar Iranian attacks on shipping, and the fact that no proxy group operating in the area has the resources and proficiency to act with such a high degree of sophistication."
On Thursday night, the United States also released video of which it claimed was Iran's Revolutionary Guard removing an unexploded mine from the side of the Japanese oil tanker attacked. However, the president of the Japanese company that owns the ship said it was not attacked by mines, but two flying objects. He also said he does not believe any objects were attached to the side of the ship. Iranian ships did approach the oil tankers after the attack, but according to multiple news accounts, the Iranians helped rescue dozens of crew members from the tankers. The timing of the incident also raised many questions, as it came as Japanese Prime Minister was visiting Iran in an attempt to bring Iran and the United States to the negotiating table. Iranian-American Trita Parsi said, quote, "Sounds like some are afraid Japan may succeed in starting diplomacy. The message appears to be, don't you dare stand in the way of my war plans," Trita Parsi said. Last month, the U.S. blamed Iran for attacking four other oil tankers in the Persian Gulf, but offered no evidence. Well, for more, we're joined now by Vijay Prashad, director of Tricontinental Institute for Social Research, chief editor of Leftward Books. He's also the chief correspondent of Globetrotter. He's the author of several books, including The Poorer Nations, A Possible History of the Global South. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Vijay Prashad. Respond to what's happening right now in the Gulf of Oman.
Hello, Amy. It's, I think, important to pay attention to the words you just used. You said that only hours after the attack or the bombings in the Norwegian and Japanese tanker, the U.S. Secretary of State went out there and blamed Iran. Hours after. You know, it's very interesting. There's a kind of rush to blame Iran for anything that's been happening around the Gulf of Hormuz. People who look closely at the oil business understand that 50% of the world's oil goes through the Gulf of Hormuz. They understand that, you know, carrying oil is a dangerous activity. All kinds of things happen. There are accidents. There's piracy. There are a series of, you know, quite common risks faced by oil tankers. Iran is not one of those high on the list as far as risk assessors are concerned. And yet, of course, this is the first thing the United States government has said, as you said, without any evidence. So within a few hours and without any evidence, the United States government once more provoking some sort of, you know, response from Iran, perhaps, or at least to try to, you know, galvanize public opinion to believe that Iran is, you know, a threat to the world. What's really important here is, yes, the fact that Shinzo Abe, the first Japanese prime minister to visit Iran in 41 years, he goes to Iran shortly after the Iranian foreign minister visited him in Japan. In fact, Mr. Zarif visited Shinzo Abe in his home. They had a very important conversation where Shinzo Abe said that the Iranian nuclear deal is a factor of stability for West Asia. You know, this goes directly opposed to the Trump administration's view. And what's very important here is we're not talking about a country that's far from American, you know, the American orbit. This is Japan, a reliable ally of the United States, which is, you know, not only reliant upon Iranian oil, but understands that the warmongering in West Asia is going to be very bad, not only for Eurasia, but for the world. And I think we need to understand that as Shinzo Abe is in Japan, this attack or this, you know, sabotage or whatever it is
in Iran,
took place on the Norwegian and Japanese tankers.
Again, as Shinzo Abe is in Iran.
That's right. He was in Tehran the first time in 41 years. And he has been saying, actually, interestingly, and this is a right-wing prime minister. This is not a person of the left. He's been saying that there needs to be a return to the table. It's not only Japan saying this, Amy. It's also the Europeans. The Europeans are very keen that the U.S. Not break fully from this Iran deal. The Germans, in fact, have been looking for an alternative mechanism for payments. You know, India, which was one of the largest purchasers of Iranian oil, had to back off because of these new, very tight sanctions put in place by the U.S. government. But the Indians are also not that interested in this new approach by the Trump administration. They would like to continue to buy oil. In fact, it's a kind of isolation that the United States is facing. It's isolated alongside the Israelis, the Saudis, and the United Arab Emirates. Nobody else wants war. Nobody else wants this deal to end. And so I think it's really out of frustration that you see the United States jump the gun, come in very quickly and say that, you know, Iran is doing this, Iran is doing that, and therefore we have to retaliate. It's important to remember that in 2017, the CIA created a special unit called the Iran Mission Center, run by Michael DeAndre. And this is an important outfit because its entire mandate has been to ratchet up pressure on Iran. Now, I don't know what happened to the Norwegian oil tanker or the Japanese oil tanker, but I'd be very interested to hear what the Iran Mission Center at the CIA has been up to since 2017.
Iran's foreign minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif, tweeted Thursday, reported attacks on Japan-related tankers occurred while PM Abe Shinzo was meeting with Ayatollah Khamenei for extensive and friendly talks. Suspicious doesn't begin to describe what likely transpired this morning. Iran's proposed regional dialogue forum is imperative, he said. Vijay Prashad.
You know, Mr. Zarif is a very capable diplomat, a very reasonable person. He has been leading Iranian diplomacy and has opened many doors to a diplomatic solution for the standoff around Iran. And I think we need to take seriously what Mr. Zarif is saying here. When he uses the word suspicious, I think we should underline that word. Again, I'm not saying what happened in the Gulf of Hormuz is very clear, that there are alternative explanations. We don't know what happened. We should be suspicious of the narrative put forward by the U.S. State Department, but we should also be suspicious about what happened. We need to ask more questions. I mean, consider this from a regional standpoint. The United States, the Russians and others are in the middle of a very serious diplomatic effort in Afghanistan. There are meetings that the U.S. has held in Doha, Qatar. There are meetings that the Russians have held in Moscow to dial down the almost 19-year war that has been taking place in Afghanistan. Imagine if the United States strikes against Iran right now. It would bring catastrophe further to Afghanistan. It would open up the wounds in Iraq and in Syria. Mr. Zarif has made it very clear that an attack on Iran is not merely an attack on Iran. It's going to create even more catastrophe in that region. That's one of the main reasons, Amy, why the Chinese are very interested in not allowing any kind of war in that region. They have a lot at stake, especially in terms of their Belt and Road Initiative, which cuts right through this region, goes through Iran. Nobody wants a war here. It's important for Americans to understand that the U.S. government is deeply isolated on this issue of Iran and on the way that the U.S. government portrays Iran. In the rest of the world, Iran is seen as a stabilizing force in that region. For some strange reason, the U.S. government believes that Iran is an interloper. In other words, there are almost 80 million Iranians who live in West Asia, and they somehow are seen to be out of place, whereas the United States, which is, you know, thousands of miles away, portrays itself as a regional actor. This is very bizarre for people around the world, and I think Americans need to understand that.
On Thursday, members of the House Armed Services Committee from both parties said Pompeo told them in a classified briefing that the United States could use the 2001 Authorization for the Use of Military Force, or AUMF, to attack Iran without congressional approval. This is Michigan Democrat Alyssa Slotkin.
We were absolutely presented with a full formal presentation on how the 2001 AUMF might authorize war on Iran. Yes, I'm sorry, sir. Secretary Pompeo said it with his own words.
The AUMF was passed in the wake of the 9/11 attacks and authorizes the president to take military action against those responsible, along with any, quote, associated forces. Your response to that, Vijay Prashad, and what role do you think Saudi Arabia is playing in all of this?
I mean, look, this is very chilling, very disturbing. You know, they are marching us directly into a war. In other words, they are marching the world into war. They're pushing Iran. The sanctions have had a catastrophic impact on Iran's external revenues, its ability to earn money. There is, you know, serious medical crisis inside the country. I think focus should be on that. You know, we've already seen how sanctions destroy countries, how they put a lot of stress on the country. But that's not the focus of anybody's attention. You know, we're allowing people like Mr. Pompeo, John Bolton, and others to set the agenda here. You know, they are being allowed to say that Iran is a criminal country and must be therefore attacked. I think this is very disturbing. Saudi Arabia, of course, is playing a lead role in this. I mentioned the Iran Mission Center. Mr. Michael Andreas is very close to the Saudis. In fact, has played an important role in the CIA's drone program and is likely to have had some role in Saudi war on Yemen. So, I mean, this is something for people to consider. This very quick march to war must be stopped. I mean, the reason I'm saying this, it's not just about Iran. It's about the region. It's about Eurasia. And the Trump administration, I think, is playing fast and loose with the facts and is being very reckless with world affairs on this. You know, we see the Trump administration behaving recklessly, mercurially perhaps, in other parts of the world. That's true. But with Iran, I think their finger is right on the trigger. And the very fact that Pompeo gave this briefing should suggest to people that this is not the time to be cynical, to sit back and say, I don't think they're going to do it. It's very likely that the United States is going to make some strike on Iran. And that strike is going to open further the gates of hell for the region.
Vijay Prashad, director of Transcontinental Institute for Social Research, chief editor of Leftward Words. We're going to break right now. And when we come back, I want to ask you about the extradition proceedings that have begun against Julian Assange, who's in the Belmarsh prison in London, and look at why one of his friends, the internet activist Ola Bini, has been jailed in Ecuador for over 2 months, picked up the same day as Julian Assange. This is Democracy Now! Back with Vijay Prashad in a minute. Future is here, Salida Kenny, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In London, WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange appeared before a magistrate's court today, saying his life was effectively at stake if the UK honors an extradition request from the United States, where he faces 17 counts of espionage. Assange is the first journalist or publisher to be indicted under the World War I-era law. While Assange's case has dominated international headlines, far less attention has been paid to a friend of Julian Assange, who's been jailed in Ecuador since April 11th, the same day Assange was taken by force by British authorities from the Ecuadorian embassy in London. Ola Bini is a Swedish programmer and data privacy activist who lives in Ecuador. He has not yet been charged with any crimes, has not been permitted to post bail for his release. The U.S. Justice Department has now said they want to question Ola Bini. Critics say Bini is being targeted because he knew and had visited Assange multiple times at the embassy in London, as well as for his own activism. This is a statement from his lawyers, Carlos Soria, speaking last month.
This is an embarrassment. Our client is someone who is innocent and who has contributed to the entire world, the development of information privacy. And now, just because he is a friend to Julian Assange or because he travels, they put him in prison. There are no words for this, and we will denounce it both nationally and internationally.
I may go to them.
We cannot allow Ecuador to look like this, like a state that persecutes people for the books they read, for the technology they use, or for the simple reason of having a friend who is currently being reproached by the world. Before, Assange was appreciated for letting the world know the atrocities committed in other parts of the world.
Still with us is Vijay Prashad, the director of Tricontinental Institute for Social Research. Earlier this week, he published a piece about Olabini in the Daily Hampshire Gazette titled, My Friend is in a Prison in Ecuador. Why is he there? Why was he picked up, Vijay Prashad? Why was Olabini picked up and jailed in Ecuador the same day Julian Assange was forcibly removed from the Ecuadorian embassy and put in the Belmarsh prison in London?
You know, Amy, this is a difficult story for me. I've known Olabini for many years. It is still perplexing to myself and to the friends of Ola why he's in prison, the Alinka prison in Quito, Ecuador. We don't know why he's in prison. There's no charge against him. There's been some allegations made about his friendship to Julian Assange. But, you know, Amy, if that's a crime, you and I should be in jail as well. We have also met him. We have, understood that meeting him is itself not a criminal activity. Olabini is a programmer who spent most of his life trying to create tools to help human rights activists create a shield against surveillance by governments. People who are in the tech world might know the programs called the Tor browser or Enigmail. These things were developed by Ola. He moved to Ecuador partly because he felt that with the government of Rafael Correa, it would be a good place to do the kind of work he was doing. Precisely the opposite of what people are alleging of him, that he broke into this, that, and the other government materials. In fact, the opposite. He would create shields to prevent governments from breaking into the kind of, databases held by human rights defenders. You've got to remember that in the Edward Snowden's revelations, he said that the NSA had been routinely attacking the servers of human rights and other civil society organizations. It was precisely Ola's, mission in life to protect those organizations. He was picked up on April 11th at Quito Airport while he was on his way to an advertised martial arts training course in Japan. He's been held in prison for 2 months. There have been two hearings. No bail has been allowed and no charge has been put forward. The prosecution in Ecuador has made it seem like a sinister thing that Ola has many computers and zip drives and so on. You know, when I travel to places, I carry about 10 to 12 zip drives. That's because I keep a zip drive for each story. It's got nothing in it, say, to be something, sinister or bizarre. These are things that software developers have. They tried to make him seem like a sinister character. I was even told by another reporter that people were asking if Ola was the code cracker for Julian Assange, which he, of course, was not and could not have been the code cracker at all when the materials passed on by Chelsea Manning came to the WikiLeaks organization. You know, that was one of the allegations that was floating around, not put on paper. Ola only met Julian when he was already in the Ecuadorian embassy, long after the revelations, the very important, crucial revelations that came from Chelsea Manning, also now in prison. I personally feel that the U.S. government, in trying to make a case against Julian Assange, has sort of swept up people that it thinks might have some evidence against Julian. For instance, having Chelsea Manning once more in prison, having Ola sit in a prison in Ecuador, squeezing them to see if they can either provide evidence against Julian. In Chelsea's case, she has said she will not do so. In Ola's case, he says, I don't have any evidence, or that they will point the investigators in a direction to get Julian. I mean, we've got to understand that there is a vendetta by the American state against Julian Assange. That's very clear. And I think there's a lot of collateral damage around the world in the U.S. state's attempt to put Julian either in prison for the full length of his life or near that.
I want to turn to Olabini speaking last month to CNN in Espanol, CNN in Spanish.
They will find nothing because I haven't done anything. The only thing I've done is being the friend of Julian Assange. The Minister of the Interior, Maria Paula Romo, goes on TV the same day as I'm detained at the airport and talks 5 hours before my detention order is written, says on TV that I'm detained. that feels to me like the government is out to get me.
Why do you have the impression that Moreno hates you?
I don't say in my letter that he hates me. Okay. I wonder if he hates me.
Okay.
Because subjecting me to something like this, this kind of process where I'm put in prison without any evidence, when I know that I'm innocent because I haven't done anything, that feels personal to me.
That's Ola Bini, again, speaking with CNN from jail. He was also asked by CNN about his relationship with WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange.
Just as me, he believes very strongly in the right to privacy. So the first time I went, I actually went to talk to him about these kind of things. I kept coming back because I like him, because he's a friend of mine. And I kept coming back because more and more people abandoned him. I felt that it was my responsibility to do it. But also it was my pleasure as a friend.
So if Vijay Prashad, if you could comment further again, he's speaking from jail to CNN. In the case of Julian Assange, we understand that Ecuador was handing over all of his electronic equipment, his hard drives, et cetera, to the British government. What's happening with Ola Bini's electronic equipment, his phones, his computers? Has the U.S. requested that equipment?
Well, the United States has been giving the Ecuadorian officials so-called, you know, expertise and help in breaking, you know, some of the barriers that Ola, you know, Ola is a very clever person. He has put all kinds of protections to his materials. These are basically off-the-shelf protections called OTR, off the record, and so on. So the Americans initially said that they were going to just assist the Ecuadorians. Now it seems that the U.S. government has asked for this material to be handed over to the United States directly. I just want to say something about Ecuador. You know, Ola was asked in that interview if Lenin Moreno hates him. That's the president of Ecuador. It's very important to remember that shortly before the Ecuadorian government handed over Julian Assange to the British police, the International Monetary Fund provided Ecuador with a loan of $4.2 billion. And there was also a commercial package of about $6 billion. So a total of $10 billion was transferred to the Ecuadorian government by the auspices of the IMF. This happened just before Julian Assange was handed over to the British authorities, just before Ola was arrested. I mean, we've got to understand the position when you look at these things in sequence. It looks like there must have been a deal. This big, huge package was given to the Ecuadorians. At the same time, you know, there's been an enormous leak of private information from the phone and Gmail account of President Moreno. This information, called the INA or INA papers, shows direct corruption by Mr. Moreno, including an apartment in Madrid, Spain, and so on. He's been deeply embarrassed by this and has been lashing out, saying that there are Russian hackers inside Ecuador. In fact, the first arrest of Ola at the airport, the piece of paper he was shown had a Russian name on it. And it was said that it's a Russian person. When Ola said, "That's not me, I'm not Russian," they took the paper away, went back, made a new document with Ola's name on it and saying he was Swedish and picked him up. So there's a very strange story here, Amy. We don't know all the parts of it yet, but we need to put the IMF into the picture. I think we need to put the fact that there's pressure from the United States on Ecuador now. First, of course, to hand over Julian Assange, and now to, you know, in a sense, do something, we don't know what, to Ola Bini.
And very quickly, have you spoken to him in jail? What are the conditions like there?
The conditions are very difficult for Ola. Ola is a vegetarian. He's had a hard time there. And as he said very early into his arrest, that the conditions in Ecuador are bad for all prisoners, Ecuadorian and himself, who's a Swedish person living in Ecuador. He is a very decent and upstanding person. He refused to allow this to become merely about himself, saying the conditions for Ola Bini are bad. He said directly they're bad for everybody.
And, but it's been Sweden, very difficult. Is Sweden doing anything about getting him out?
The Swedish government called in the Ecuadorian ambassador, but Sweden has very little leverage on Ecuador. In fact, it doesn't have an ambassador in Ecuador, just a council. We are hoping that pressure from the UN Special Rapporteur David Kaye, who has called this an arbitrary detention, will have some impact on other European countries. Even the OAS Special Rapporteur has said that this is a very arbitrary, dangerous situation, should not be allowed. But, you know, the ability of these UN rapporteurs to move an agenda is very limited. And I'm afraid that the pressure from the United States government on Ecuador has basically invalidated the moral standing of European countries and even the United Nations.
Vijay Prashad, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Director of Tricontinental Institute for Social Research. We will continue to follow Ola Bini's case, as well as the case of Julian Assange, both picked up more than 2 months ago. Ola Bini remains imprisoned in Ecuador, and Julian Assange going through extradition hearings right now to the United States at the Belmarsh Prison in London. Coming up, we look at Advocate, a new prize-winning documentary about the pioneering Israeli attorney Leah Tzemel, who spent 5 decades defending Palestinians who resist the Israeli occupation. Stay with us. Simone. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Attorney Leah Tzemel has defended Palestinian political prisoners in Israeli courts for nearly half a century, insisting on their humanity and their right to a fair trial. Her work has earned her the scorn and reprobation of many Israelis, as well as death threats. A staunch critic of the Israeli occupation of Palestine, Tzemel has long argued Palestinians who carry out politically motivated violence are freedom fighters, not terrorists. In 1999, Leah Tzemel won a landmark case in the Israeli Supreme Court, making it illegal for Israeli officials to torture or detain Palestinians during interrogations. The documentary, titled Advocate, tells the remarkable story of Leah Tzemel's life. This is the film's trailer.
My next guest is no doubt very controversial, right? So they say. Good morning, attorney Leah Tzemel.
How do we reach the detention cells? With the elevator. Is it going down?
Leah, what will become of you?
What do you think?
When will you mend your ways?
Who, me? I'm a lost cause.
A rebel with a lost cause.
A rebel with a lost cause.
You defend terrorists and their families. I imagine you differently, taller and tougher.
I left my devil's tail at home this time.
You've been called that, no?
Yeah. Devil, stuff like that. I've been called every name in the book.
Like what else?
Traitor, leftist, devil's advocate. The usual.
Does it hurt you?
No, there are times when being called those things is a compliment. I always took it as a compliment.
Advocate premiered at this year's Sundance Film Festival. The documentary screened for the first time in New York City last night as the opening of the Human Rights Watch Film Festival. The film was recently named Best Picture in Tel Aviv's annual Doc Aviv Film Festival. The Israeli cultural minister, Mary Regev, condemned the decision to honor the film. Well, for more, we're joined by Leah Tzemel herself, as well as the film's director, Rachel Leah Jones. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! It's wonderful to have you with us. Rachel, why don't we begin with you? Why you made this film?
Why do we make any film? Leah is the kind of Israeli I wanted to be. I mean, I grew up in Israel. I left. I came back as a young adult after the first Intifada. I had heard about her. I wanted to meet her. She's one of the first people I met when I went back as a young adult. And she modeled for me the kind of Israeli I wanted to be. Somebody completely critical and completely, at the same time, not thinking of going anywhere else. Just thinking, how do you get people to live together in that space? Equality, and with obviously human rights, civil rights, it goes without saying, but just with a basic understanding that the place has to be shared in complete and full equality.
Leah Tzemel, talk about being an Israeli, how you grew up, and what made you decide to represent Palestinians.
I would see myself as a typical Israeli, Sabra, if you want. I was born there in 1945 and then grew up with the state. And I was studying law in 1967 when the war broke. Until then, I would say I was a normal, regular Israeli. And once the war broke, I realized that the people, were misled before the war to believe that this is a war for peace. Israel didn't think of creating peace. And I found myself having to decide whether my humanity prevails when I saw what happened to the Palestinians in the occupied territories, or my Israeli loyalty would prevail. And I chose my humanity. Therefore, when I became a lawyer, it was only natural that I would try to defend the underdogs, the Palestinians, while thinking all the time of the only possible solution to the conflict there, one equality, two or one state, it doesn't make a difference really, but freedom for the Palestinians, recognition of what we have caused to them, and ability to continue together with equality, which is the most important. Equality and freedom, of course, for both people.
I wanted to turn to a clip from the film Advocate that features Dr. Hanan Ashrawi, the longtime Palestinian diplomat and scholar.
And I was arrested. I was looking for a lawyer. And from that day on, I mean, Leah was really part of our experience of struggle at Birzeit State University during, you know, all these closures, during all these military incursions, the shootings, the arrests, and so on. It was Leah who was there all the time. To us, being a prisoner is a fact of life. Every home, every family has had at least one prisoner, if not more. Many families have had martyrs. Many families have had people, you know, deported. Many families have had their homes destroyed. But every family can tell you, I have prisoners in my midst. The Israelis reached into my home and extracted my son, my daughter, my husband, my brother, and took him or her away. And it was Leah who was there saying, I will try to bring him or her back. Leah went to court to help our students, and I was nursing, I was breastfeeding Zaina, and Talila got hungry, so I breastfed her as well. And so now we have their milk sisters. It's in our tradition when two babies are fed the same mother's milk, they become sisters, and this is a very strong bond.
I really don't feel the gap of a Palestinian, a Jew, I don't think we ever had it between us.
She was very human. She was the only one really who recognized this in the Greek sense of anagnorisis. You know, I recognize your humanity and what you're going through. If you are fighting against injustice and you don't have any other tools, you adopt the tools that are available. You manufacture your own tools. Some people turn their bodies into tools. They don't have, you know, warplanes, they don't have tanks, they have bodies. And it doesn't mean she condoned this or she thought it was right, but she said you have to understand it in the context within which this happened. This is a very difficult and rare situation where you could look at the victim come violent person and understand the motives for violence and understand that this is a response to a greater form of violence. You are not abstract, labeled terrorists.
So that's Dr. Hanan Ashrawi, the longtime Palestinian diplomat and scholar. She was just on Democracy Now! A few weeks ago. Layat Samal, continue along the lines of what Dr. Ashrawi was talking about, who you come to represent. People who have been accused of violence, Palestinians who've been accused of violence, and those who simply have been arrested.
I think most of the people that I represent are Palestinians who are acting against the occupation in this way or another, or that have been tackled with problems that the occupation created. Like if we talk about Jerusalem, the Jerusalemite Palestinians have difficulties in getting a position, in getting their rights, in getting their identification cards, in getting family reunification, for instance. So these are the civil aspects of the occupation that I'm also dealing with. Besides, of course, people who have committed security offenses, as they call it, and I believe that I'm obliged to defend them. I believe they have the right to act against the occupation, like every person on this earth has the right to act against any occupation. And I don't try to condemn them. I try to be near them and have my ability as a lawyer and recruit the Israeli law to defend them.
Let's go to another clip from Advocate. Layat Samal, along with a team of human rights lawyers, argued before Israel's Supreme Court against torture carried out by the Israeli security forces. In 1999, 20 years ago, the Israeli Supreme Court ruled the practice is illegal.
After a decade of legal battles, they posed for a victory photo.
We made history today. What a moving decision. A just ruling, a warranted ruling. Too bad we didn't conduct the struggle 30 years ago.
9 years, nine justices, and one Supreme Court bottom line. All interrogation methods that entail physical pressure are illegal.
As soon as the Supreme Court handed down its decision, I knew that, for once, we'd won. The security service had been exposed. It was a wonderful feeling. I wanted to burst into song.
It was 20 years ago, Layat Samal. You won. You're not used to winning. All of these years, 50 years, how many cases have you won?
First of all, it's not my personal win. We were a group of lawyers, we were a group of human rights organizations that have appealed for many, many years on this subject of torture. And it was a big victory, it's true. The victory was somehow eaten away during the years. The security services found other ways that some are also illegal. And the
you're saying that the security forces are continuing to torture Palestinians in prison?
In this way or another, yeah. With permission, with authorization sometimes. But the situation continues. And the struggle continues. We know it very, very well. So it was a highlight in the career, undoubtedly. There are not too many winnings we can talk about. There are many failures. And altogether, I think that the Israeli society has failed to rebut and fight against the occupation as we should.
Early in your career, talk about the Arab-Israeli Alliance, the group of young men who you represented that are portrayed and advocate.
You know, we all started as young, ambitious, hopeful revolutionaries, believing that we can change here and now the situation. And some of our leftist groups then even went further on to join a Palestinian leading group. And then they were, of course, detained and sentenced with a lot of scandalous reactions to 17 years in prison, like Udi Adiv, a kibbutznik, who was the head of that group, and others. And since then, we didn't see the repetitive of that phenomenon. We do see cooperation. At times, you know, there is now BDS, so it's more difficult to talk to cooperate. But I still carry the dream of a common future that we share with the Palestinians, and I don't see ourselves living there without this cooperation.
You also represented your own husband, Michel Orshovsky, yeah. Famous right. Peace activist, yeah. When he was jailed as head of the Alternative Information Center.
Yes, he was charged with publishing in his office a booklet of how to sustain torture by the security services and what are the security services' methods of torture. And, of course, this was shushu. You cannot talk about it. You should not expose it, especially it was they intended to write it in Arabic. So, of course, you cannot tell it to the Arabs. They would know what they are anticipating in the interrogation rooms. So he was detained, and later on, very little came out of it. But he served some time in prison, and
So you won, to a certain extent. At least you won your husband yeah. back. Let's go to a yeah. new clip of the documentary Advocate featuring our guest, the pioneering Israeli attorney, Leah Tzemel.
When I ask myself about red lines, I ask it in reverse. I don't have a moral conflict with saying yes, but with saying no. That's my contemplation. When am I allowed to say no? So I set the following framework for myself. I'm an Israeli occupier no matter what I do. I enjoy the fruits of occupation, both bitter and sweet. And I didn't manage, despite my moral obligation as an Israeli, to change the regime and its policies. On what moral grounds should I judge the people who resist my occupation and hand out grades? That's good, that's bad. If you're a nonviolent demonstrator and they shoot you dead, you're good. But if you have a knife and they shoot you dead, you're bad. Who gave me that right? So in that sense, if the act is intended to resist the occupation as such, I'll take it on.
So that's another clip from Advocate, and that is Leah Tzemel speaking in Hebrew, translated. Advocate was just named Best Picture in Tel Aviv's annual Doc Aviv Film Festival. The Israeli cultural minister, Mary Regev, condemned the decision to honor the film. Rachel Leah Jones, you're the filmmaker. Your response to this?
Doc Aviv was a huge surprise. We had 5 sold-out screenings. Roughly 1,800 Israeli Jews came to see the film over the course of a week, and not a single person complained. On the contrary, people were crying, laughing, hugging, elated. It was beyond my wildest dreams or expectations for how a film like this could be received in this day and age in Israel.
And we
won first prize. Miri Regev, the culture minister, has been condemning films like this since she came into position to power.
And the film is Oscar qualified. That does it for this segment. We'll do part 2. Post online at democracynow.org. Israeli human rights advocate Leah Tzemel, Rachel Leah Jones, director of Advocate. That's it for our show. Welcome to the world, Ryan Joseph Crosby Wallach. Congratulations to our colleagues. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.